A funnel of water surged up, drawn from the river beneath. Egwene blew her tornado of water into the Trollocs that were beginning their assault against her army's left flank on the Kandori side of the river. Her tempest of water surged across them. It wasn't strong enough to pull any of them into the air. She didn't have the energy for that. But it drove them back, hands to their faces. Behind her and the other Aes Sedai positioned on the Arafelan side of the river, archers loosed volleys of arrows into the sky. Those didn't darken the sky the way she would have liked. There weren't so many. But they did take down more than 100 Trollocs with each wave. To the side, Pilar and a couple of other Browns, all adept with weaves of earth, caused the ground to erupt under the charging Trollocs. Spread out next to her, Mirel and a large contingent of Greens wove fireballs that they lobbed over the water into bunched-up groups of Trollocs, many of whom continued to run a considerable distance before they collapsed, engulfed in flames. The Trollocs howled and roared, but continued their relentless progress against the defenders at the river's edge. At one point, several ranks of Shanshan cavalry moved out from the defensive lines and attacked the Trolloc onslaught head-on. It happened so quickly that many of the Trollocs were unable to raise their spears before contact was made. Large swaths of the foe in the front ranks went down. The Shanshan swept to the side and returned to their lines at the river. Egwene held to her channeling, forcing herself to work through sheer exhaustion. But the Trollocs didn't break. They grew enraged, attacking the humans with a frenzy. Egwene could hear their yells distinctly over the sounds of wind and water. The Trollocs grew angry, did they? Well, they would not know anger until they had felt that of the Ammerlin's seat. Egwene pulled in more and more of the power until she was at the very edges of her ability. She put heat into her tempest, so that the scalding water burned Trolloc eyes, hands, hearts. She felt herself yelling, Vora's Sa'angreal thrust before her like a spear. What seemed like hours went by. Eventually, exhausted, she allowed Gawain to talk her into pulling back for a time. Gawain went to fetch her horse, and as he was returning, Egwene looked across the river. There was no doubt about it. Her army's left flank had already been pushed another 30 paces. Even with the Aes Sedai aid, they were losing this battle. It was long past time for her to find Gareth Bryn. When Egwene and Gawain got back to camp, she climbed from her horse and gave it to Lyalwyn, telling her to use it to help carry the wounded. There were plenty of those who had been dragged across the ford to safety, bloodied soldiers slumping against the arms of friends. Unfortunately, she hadn't the strength for healing, let alone a gateway to send wounded to Tar Valon or Mayenne. Most of the Aes Sedai not busy at the riverbank didn't look as if they were doing any better. "Egwene," Gawain said softly. "Rider, Shanshan. Looks like a noblewoman." One of the blood, Egwene thought, standing and looking through camp toward where Gawain pointed. At least he had the strength left to keep a lookout. Why any woman would voluntarily go without a warder was beyond her. The woman approaching wore fine Shanshan silks, and Egwene's stomach turned at the sight. That finery existed because of a foundation of enslaved channelers, forced into obedience to the Crystal Throne. The woman was certainly one of the blood, as a contingent of Death Watch guards accompanied her. You had to be very important for— "Light!" Gawain exclaimed. "Is that Min?" Egwene gaped. It was. Min rode up, scowling. "Mother," she said to Egwene, bowing her head amid her stone-faced guards in dark armor. "Min, are you well?" Egwene asked. "Careful. Don't give out too much information." Was Min a captive? Surely she couldn't have joined the Shanshan, could she? "Oh, I'm well," Min said sourly. I've been pampered, stuffed in this outfit, and offered all sorts of somewhat delicate foods. I might add that among the Shanshan, delicate does not necessarily mean tasty. You should see the things they drink, Egwene. I've seen them, Egwene said, unable to keep her tone from coldness. Oh, yes, I suppose you have. Mother, we have a problem. What kind of problem? Well, it depends on how much you trust Matt. I trust him to find trouble, Egwene said. I trust him to find drinking and gambling no matter where he goes. Do you trust him to lead an army? Min asked. Egwene hesitated. Did she? Min leaned forward, sparing a glance for the Death Watch guards, who didn't seem about to let her draw any closer to Egwene. Egwene, she said softly, Matt thinks that Bryn is leading your army to destruction. He says he thinks Bryn is a dark friend. Gawain started laughing. Egwene jumped. She would have expected anger from him. Outrage.
Gareth Bryn? Gawain asked. A dark friend? I'd believe my own mother to be a dark friend before him. Tell Cawthon to stay out of his wife's royal brandy. He's obviously had too much.
I'm inclined to agree with Gawain, Egwene said slowly. Still, she could not ignore the irregularities in how the army was being led. She would sort through that. Matt is always looking out for people who don't need to be looked out for, she said. He's just trying to protect me. Tell him that we appreciate the warning. Mother, Min said. He seemed certain. This isn't a joke. He wants you to turn your armies over to him. My armies, Egwene said flatly. Yes, in the hands of Matrim Cawthon. Yes, I should mention the Empress has given him command of all the Shanshan forces. He's now Marshal General Cawthon.
Taviren.
Egwene shook her head. Matt is a good tactician, but handing him the White Tower's armies? No, that is beyond possibility. Besides, the armies are not mine to give him. The Hall of the Tower has authority for them. So how can we persuade these gentlemen surrounding you that you'll be safe accompanying me? As little as Egwene wanted to admit it, she needed the Shanshan. She wouldn't risk their alliance to save Min, particularly since it didn't seem that she was in immediate danger. Of course, if the Shanshan realized that Min had sworn their oaths back in Falma, then fled. Don't worry about me, Min said with a grimace. I suppose I'm better off with Fortuona. She knows about a certain talent of mine, thanks to Matt. And it might let me help her. And you. The statement was laden with meaning. The Death Watch guards were too stoic to respond overtly to Min's use of the Empress's name, but they did seem to stiffen, their faces hardening.
Take care, Min, Egwene thought. You're surrounded by autumn thorn weeds.
Min didn't seem to care. Will you at least consider what Matt is saying?
That Gareth Bryn is a dark friend? Egwene said. It really was laughable.
Go back and tell Matt to submit his battle suggestions to us if he must. For now I need to find my commanders to plan our next steps.
Gareth Bryn, where are you?
A flight of black arrows rose almost invisibly into the air, then fell like a breaking wave. They hit Aitoralda's army at the mouth of the pass to the valley of Thakandar, some bouncing off shields, others finding flesh. One fell inches from where Aitoralda stood atop a rocky outcropping. Aitoralda didn't flinch. He stood straight-backed, hands clasped behind him. He did, however, mutter, "Letting things draw a little close, aren't we?" Binda, The Ashaman who stood beside him in the night grimaced. "Sorry, Lord Aitaralda." He was supposed to keep the arrows away. He'd done well so far. Sometimes, however, he got a distant look in his face and started muttering about them, trying to take his hands.
"Stay sharp," Aitaralda said.
His head throbbed. More dreams earlier tonight, so real. He had seen Trollocs eating members of his family alive, and had been too weak to save them. He had struggled and wept as they ate Tamsin and his children, but at the same time had been lured by the sense of the boiling and burning flesh. At the end of the dream, he had joined the monsters in their feast.
"Put that from your mind," he thought.
It was not easy to do so. The dreams had been so vivid. He had been glad to be awakened by a Trolloc attack. He'd been ready for this. His men lit bonfires at the barricades. The Trollocs had finally pushed through his thorn fortifications, but their butcher's bill had been high. Now Aitaralda's men fought at the mouth of the pass, holding the tides back from entering the valley. They had applied their time well during the days the Trollocs had pushed their way through arduous barriers to the mouth of the pass. The entrance to the valley was now fortified with a series of chest-high earthen bulwarks. These would be excellent for crossbowmen to use as cover if Aitaralda's pike formations were ever pushed back too far. For now, Aitaralda had split his army into groups of around 3,000 men each, then organized them into square formations of pikes, billhooks, and crossbows. He used mounted crossbowmen as skirmishers in the front and on the flanks, and had formed up a vanguard, about 6 ranks deep, of pikemen. Big pikes, 20 feet long. He'd learned from Maradon that you wanted to keep your distance from the Trollocs. Pikes worked wonderfully. Aitaralda's pike squares could pivot and fight in all directions in case they were surrounded. Trollocs could be forced to fight in ranks, but these squares, properly applied, could break up their lines. Once the Trolloc ranks were shattered, the Aiel could kill with abandon. Behind ranks of pikemen he positioned foot soldiers carrying billhooks and halberds. Sometimes Trollocs fought their way through the pikes, pushing the weapons aside, or pulling them down with the weight of corpses. The billhookmen then moved up, slipping between the pikemen, and hamstrung the leading Trollocs. This gave the leading foot soldiers time to pull back and regroup, while the next wave of soldiers, more foot with pikes, moved up to engage the Trollocs. It was working, so far. He had a dozen such squares of troops facing the Trollocs in the night. They fought defensively, doing whatever they could to break the surging tide. The Trollocs threw themselves at the pikemen, trying to crack them, but each square operated independently. Aitaralda didn't worry about the Trollocs that made it through the gauntlet, because they would be handled by the Aiel. Aitaralda had to keep his hands clasped behind his back to conceal their shaking. Nothing had been the same after Maradon. He'd learned, but he'd paid dearly for that education.
"Burn these headaches," he thought, "and burn those Trollocs."
3 times he had nearly given the order to send his armies in with a direct assault, abandoning the square formations. He could imagine them slaughtering, killing, no more delaying. He wanted blood. Each time he'd stopped himself. They weren't here for blood, they were here to hold, to give that man the time he needed in the cavern. That was what it was all about. Wasn't it? Why did he have such terrible trouble remembering that lately? Another wave of Trolloc arrows dropped onto Aitaralda's men. The Fades had some of them stationed on the tops of the slopes above the pass in places that Aitaralda's own archers had once held. Getting them up there must have been quite an undertaking. The walls of the pass were very steep. How many would have dropped to their deaths making the attempt? Regardless, Trollocs weren't good shots with bows, but they didn't need to be when firing at armies. The halberdiers raised shields. They couldn't fight while holding those, but they kept them strapped to their backs for need. The falling arrows increased, plummeting through the lightly foggy night air. The storm rumbled overhead, but the windfinders were at their task again, keeping it away. They claimed that at several moments the army had been mere breaths away from an all-out storm of destruction. At one point, hail the size of a man's fist had fallen for about a minute before they'd wrested control of the weather again. If that was what awaited them if the Windfinders weren't using their bowl, Iteralda was more than happy to leave them at their task. The Dark One wouldn't care how many Trollocs he destroyed while sending a blizzard, twister, or hurricane to kill the humans they fought.
"They're gathering for another surge at the mouth of the pass," someone yelled in the night air,
followed by other calls confirming it. Iteralda peered through the mist, aided by light from the bonfires. The Trollocs were indeed regrouping.
"Withdraw the 7th and 9th Infantry squads," Iteralda said. "They've been at it too long. Pull the 4th and 5th out of reserve and have them take flanking positions. Prepare for more arrows, and..."
He trailed off, frowning. What were those Trollocs doing? They'd pulled back farther than he'd have expected, drawing into the darkness of the pass. They couldn't be retreating, could they? A dark wave slid out of the mouth of the pass. Murdral. Hundreds upon hundreds of them. Black cloaks that did not move in defiance of the breeze. Faces with no eyes, lips that sneered, black swords. The creatures moved like eels, sinuous and sleek. They gave no time for orders, no time for response. They flowed into the squares of defenders, sliding between pikes, whipping deadly swords.
"Aiel!" Iteralda bellowed. "Bring in the Aiel! All of them! And channelers! Everyone except for those who guard at the Pit of Doom itself! Move! Move!"
Messengers scrambled away. Iteralda watched in horror. An army of Murdral. Light, it was as bad as his nightmares. The 7th Infantry collapsed before the attack, square formation shattering. Iteralda opened his mouth to order the primary reserve, the one defending his position, to give support. He needed the cavalry to ride out and draw pressure off the infantry. He didn't have much cavalry. He'd agreed that most of the horsemen would be needed on other fronts. But he did have some. They'd be essential here. Except... He squeezed his eyes shut. Light, but he was exhausted. He had trouble thinking. "Pull back before the attack," a voice seemed to be saying to him. "Pull back to the Aiel, then make a stand there."
"Pull back," he whispered. "Pull."
Something felt very, very wrong about doing that. Why was his mind insisting upon it?
"Captain Tahara," Iteralda tried to whisper, "you have command."
It wouldn't come out. Something physical seemed to be holding his mouth shut. He could hear men screaming. What was happening? Dozens of men could die fighting a single Murdral. At Maradon, he'd lost an entire company of archers, 100 men to 2 Fades who had slipped into the city at night. His defensive squads were built to deal with Trollocs, to hamstring them, to drop them. The Fades would crack those pike squares open like eggs. Nobody was doing what needed to be done.
"My lord Iteralda," Captain Tahara said. "My lord, what was it you said?"
If they retreated, the Trollocs would surround them. They needed to stand firm. Iteralda's lips opened to give the order to retreat.
"Pull the..."
Wolves. Wolves appeared in the fog like shadows. They leaped at the Murdral, growling. Iteralda started, spinning, as a man in furs pulled himself up onto the top of the rocky outcrop. Tahara stumbled back, calling for their guards. The newcomer in furs leaped for Iteralda and shoved him off the top of the rocks. Iteralda did not fight back. Whoever this man was, Iteralda was grateful to him, feeling a moment of victory as he fell. He hadn't given the order to retreat. He hit the ground, not far below, and it knocked the wind out of him. The wolves took his arms in gentle mouths and pulled him off into the darkness as he slowly drifted into unconsciousness.
Egwene sat in the camp as the battle for the border of Kandor continued. Her army held back the Trollocs. The Shan Shan fought alongside her troops just across the river. Egwene herself held a small cup of tea. Light! It was galling,
She was the Amarlin, but she was drained of energy. She still hadn't found Gareth Bryn, but that wasn't unexpected. He moved about. Sylviana was hunting him and should have word soon. Aes Sedai had been sent to take the wounded to Mayenne. The sun drooped low in the sky, like an eyelid that refused to stay open. Egwene's hand shook as she held her cup. She could still hear the battle. It seemed that the Trollocs would fight into the night, grinding the human armies against the river. Distant shouts rose like the calls of an angry crowd, but the explosions from the channelers had slowed. She turned to Gawain. He didn't seem tired at all, though he was strangely pale. Egwene sipped her tea and silently cursed him. It was unfair, but she wasn't concerned with fairness right now. She could grumble at her warder. That was what they were for, wasn't it? A breeze blew through camp. She was a few hundred paces east of the ford, but she smelled blood in the air. Nearby, a squad of archers drew their bows at their commander's call, launching a volley of arrows. A pair of black-winged drakkar plummeted moments later, hitting the ground with dull thuds just beyond camp. More would come as it grew dark, and they had an easier time hiding against the sky. Matt. She felt strangely sick, thinking about him. He was such a blowhard. A carouser, leering at every pretty woman he met, treating her like a painting and not a person. He was Matt. Once, when Egwene had been around 13, he'd jumped into the river to save Kiem Lewin from drowning. Of course she hadn't been drowning. She'd merely been dunked under the water by a friend, and Matt had come running, throwing himself into the water to help. The men of Emmons Field had made sport of him for months about that. The next spring, Matt had pulled Jer Alhune from the same river, saving the boy's life. People had stopped making fun of Matt for a while afterward. That was how Matt was. He'd grumbled and muttered all winter about how people made sport of him, insisting that next time he'd just let them drown. Then the moment he'd seen someone in danger, he'd gone splashing right back in. Egwene could remember gangly Matt stumbling from the river, little Jer clinging to him and gasping, a look of pure terror in his eyes. Jer had gone down without making a sound. Egwene had never realized that could happen. People who started to drown didn't yell or sputter or call for help. They just slipped under the water when everything seemed fine and peaceful. Unless Matt was watching. He came for me in the Stone of Tyr, she thought. Of course he'd also tried to save her from the Aes Sedai, unwilling to believe she was Amarlin. So which was this? Was she drowning or not? How much do you trust Matrim Cawthon? Min had asked. Light. I do trust him. Fool that I am, I do. Matt could be wrong. He often was wrong. But when he was right, he saved lives. Egwene forced herself to stand. She wavered, and Gawain came to her side. She patted him on the arm, then stepped away from him. She would not let the army see its Amarlin so weak that she had to lean against someone for support. What reports do we have from the other battlefronts?
Not much today, Gawain said. He frowned. In fact, it's been rather silent.
Elaine was supposed to fight at Carrion, Egwene said. It was an important battle.
She might be too occupied to send word.
I want you to send a messenger by gateway. I need to know how that battle is going. Gawain nodded, hurrying off. After he was gone, Egwene walked at a steady pace until she found Sylviana, who was talking with a pair of blue sisters. Bryn? Egwene asked.
In the mess tent, Sylviana said. I only just had word. I sent a runner to tell him to stay put until you arrived. Come.
She walked over to the tent, the largest shelter in camp by far, and spotted him as she entered.
not eating, but standing against the cook's travel table, with his map spread out. The table smelled of onions, which had probably been cut there time and time again. Yukiri had a gateway open in the floor to look down on the battlefield. She closed it as Egwene arrived. They didn't leave it open long, not with the Sharans watching for it and preparing weaves to send through it. Egwene whispered very quietly to Sylviana, "Gather the hall of the tower. Bring back any sitters you can find. Get them all here to this tent as soon as you can." Sylviana nodded, her face betraying no hint of the confusion she likely felt. She hastened off, and Egwene sat down in the tent. Swan wasn't there. She was likely helping with healing again. That was good. Egwene wouldn't have wanted to attempt this with Swan glaring at her. As it was, she worried about Gawain. He loved Bryn like a father, and already his anxiety streamed through their bond. She would have to approach this very delicately, and she didn't want to start until the hall had arrived. She couldn't accuse Bryn, but she couldn't ignore Matt. He was a scoundrel and a fool, but she trusted him. Light helper, but she did. She'd trust him with her life. And things had been going oddly on the battlefield. The sitters gathered relatively quickly. They had charge of the war effort, and they met together each evening to get reports and tactical explanations from Bryn and his commanders. Bryn didn't seem to think it odd that they came to him now. He kept at his work. Many of the women did give Egwene curious looks as they entered. She nodded to them, trying to convey the weight of the Ammerlin seat. Eventually enough of them had arrived that Egwene decided she should begin. Time was wasting. She needed to dismiss Matt's accusations from her mind once and for all, or she needed to act on them. "General Bryn," Egwene said. "Have you been well? We've had a difficult time finding you." He looked up and blinked. His eyes were red. "Mother," he said. He nodded to the sitters. "I feel tired, but probably no more than you. I've been all over the battlefield, tending to all kinds of details. You know how it is." Gawain hurried in. "Egwene," he said, his face pale. "Trouble." "What?" He took a deep breath. "General Bashir turned against Elaine. Light. He's a dark friend. The battle would have been lost had the Ashaman not arrived." "What's this?" Bryn asked, looking up from his maps. "Bashir? A dark friend?" "Yes." "Impossible," Bryn said. "He was the Lord Dragon's companion for months. I don't know him well, but a dark friend? It couldn't be."
"It is somewhat unreasonable to assume," Saren said.
"You can speak with the Queen yourself if you wish," Gawain said, standing tall. "I heard it from her own mouth."
The tent stilled. Sitters looked to one another with worried faces. "General," Egwene said to Bryn, "how was it that you sent 2 cavalry units to protect us from the Trollocs on the hills south of here, sending them into a trap, and leaving the main army's left flank exposed?"
"How was it, Mother?" Bryn asked. "It was obvious that you were about to be overrun. Anyone could see that." "Yes, I had them leave the left flank, but I moved the Ileana reserves into that position. When I saw that Sharan cavalry unit split off to attack Uno's right flank, I sent the Ileanas out to intercept them. It was the right thing to do. I didn't know there would be so many Sharans."
His voice had raised to a shout, but he stopped, and his hands were trembling.
"I made a mistake. I'm not perfect, Mother."
"This was more than a mistake," Faecella said. "I have just returned from speaking with Uno and the other survivors of that cavalry massacre. Uno said he could smell a trap as soon as he and his men started riding toward the sisters, but that you had promised him help."
"I told you," I sent him reinforcements. I just didn't expect the Sharans would send such a large force. Besides, I had it all under control. I had ordered up a Shanshan cavalry legion to reinforce our troops. They were supposed to take care of those Sharans. I had them staged across the river. I just didn't expect them to be so late.
Yes, Egwene said, hardening her voice. Those men, so many thousands of them, were crushed between the Trollocs and the Sharans with no hope for escape. You lost them, and all for no good reason.
I had to bring the Aes Sedai out, Bryn said. They're our most valuable resource. Pardon, Mother, but you have made that same point to me.
The Aes Sedai could have waited, Saren said. I was there. Yes, we needed out, we were being pressed, but we held, and could have held longer. You left thousands of good men to die, General Bryn. And you know the worst part? It was unnecessary. You left all those Shanshan across the ford here, the ones who were going to save the day, waiting for your order to attack. But that order never came, did it, General? You abandoned them, just like you abandoned our cavalry.
But I ordered them to attack. They finally went in, didn't they? I sent a messenger.
No. If it wasn't for Matt Coffin, they would still be waiting on this side of the river, General.
Egwene turned away from him.
Egwene, Gawain said, taking her arm. What are you saying? Just because...
Bryn raised a hand to his head. Then he sagged, as if suddenly his limbs had lost their strength.
I don't know what's wrong with me, he whispered, sounding hollow. I keep making mistakes, Mother. They're the kind a man can recover from, and I keep telling myself that. Then I make another mistake, and there is more scrambling to fix it.
You're just tired, Gawain said, voice pained, looking to him.
We all are.
No, Bryn said softly.
No, it's more than that. I've been tired before. This is like... My instincts are suddenly wrong. I give the orders, then afterwards I see the holes, the problems.
Compulsion, Egwene said, feeling cold. You've been compelled. They're attacking our great captains.
Several women in the room embraced the source.
How would that be possible? Gawain protested. Egwene, we have sisters watching the camp for signs of channeling.
I don't know how it happened, Egwene said. Perhaps it was put in place months ago before the battle began.
She turned to the sitters.
I move that the hall relieve Gareth Bryn as commander of our armies. It is your decision, sitters.
Light, Yukiri said.
We... Light? It must be done, Doasine said. It is a clever move, a way to destroy our armies without us seeing the trap. We should have seen. The great captains should have been better protected.
Light, Faecela said. We need to send word to Lord Mandragoran and to Thakandar. This could involve them, too. An attempt to bring down all four battle fronts at once in a coordinated attack.
I will see it done, Saren said, moving toward the tent flaps. For now, I agree with Mother. Bryn must be relieved.
One by one, the others nodded. It was not a formal vote in the hall, but it would do. Beside the table, Gareth Bryn sat down. Poor man. He was no doubt shaken, worried. Unexpectedly, he smiled.
General? Egwene asked.
Thank you, Bryn said, looking relaxed.
For what?
I feared I was losing my mind, Mother. I kept seeing what I'd done. I left thousands of men to die. But it wasn't me. It wasn't me.
Egwene, Gawain said.
He covered his pain well.
The army. If Bryn has been forced to lead us toward danger, We need to change our command structure immediately. Bring in my commanders, Bryn said. I will relinquish control to them.
And if they have been corrupted as well? Doacene asked.
I agree, Egwene said. This smells of one of the Forsaken. Perhaps Mugadin.
Lord Bryn, if you were to fall in this fight, she'd know that your commanders would be next to take charge. They might have the same faulty instincts that you do.
Doacene shook her head.
Who can we trust? Any bloody man or woman we put in command could have suffered compulsion.
We may have to lead ourselves, Faecella said. Getting to a man who cannot channel would be easier than a sister, who would sense channeling and notice a woman with the ability. We are more likely to be clean.
But who among us has the knowledge of battlefield tactics? Farana asked.
I consider myself well-read enough to oversee plans, but to make them?
We will be better than someone who may have been corrupted, Faecella said.
No, Egwene said, pulling herself up on Gawain's arm.
Then what? Gawain asked.
Egwene clenched her teeth.
Then what?
She knew of only one man she could trust not to have been compelled, at least not by Mugadin. A man who was immune to the effects of Sidar and Sidin.
We will have to put our armies under the command of Matrim Coffin, she said.
May the light watch over us.
Chapter 32 A Yellow Flower Spider. The Damani held open a hole in the floor for Matt. It looked down on the battlefield itself. Matt rubbed his chin, still impressed, though he'd been using these holes for the last hour or so as he countered the trap that Bryn had laid for Egwene's armies. He had sent in additional banners of Shanshan cavalry to reinforce both flanks of his troops at the river, and additional Damani to counter the Sharan channelers and stem the flood of Trollocs pressing against the defenders. Of course, this still wasn't as good as being down on the battlefield himself. Maybe he should go out again and do a little more fighting. He glanced at Tuon, who sat on a throne, a massive 10-foot-tall throne, at one side of the command building. Tuon narrowed her eyes at him as if she could see right into his thoughts. She's Aes Sedai, Matt told himself. Oh, she can't channel. She hasn't let herself learn yet. She's bloody one of them anyway. And I married her. She was something incredible, though. He felt a thrill each time she gave orders. She did it so naturally. Elaine and Nynaeve could take lessons. Tuon did look very nice on that throne. Matt let his gaze linger on her, and that earned him a scowl, which was downright unfair. If a man couldn't leer at his wife, who could he leer at? Matt turned back to the battlefield. Nice trick, he said, stooping down to stick his hand through the hole. They were high up. If he fell, he'd have time to hum three verses of She Has No Ankles That I Can See before he hit. Maybe an extra round of the chorus. This one learned it, the Suldam said, referring to her new Damani, from watching the weaves of the Aes Sedai. The Suldam, Katrona, almost choked on the words Aes Sedai. Matt couldn't blame her. Those could be tough words to speak. He didn't look too hard at the Damani, nor the tattoos of flowering branches on her cheeks, reaching from the back of her head like hands to cup her face. Matt was responsible for her being captured. It was better than her fighting for the Shadow, wasn't it? Blood and bloody ashes, he thought to himself. You are doing a fine job of persuading Tuon not to use Damani, Matrim Coffin, capturing one yourself. It was unnerving how quickly the Sharan woman had taken to her captivity. The Suldam had all remarked upon it. Barely a moment of struggle, then complete subservience. They expected a newly captured Damani to take months to train properly, yet this one had been ready within hours. Katrona practically beamed, as if she were personally responsible for the Sharan woman's temperament. That hole was remarkable. Matt stood right on the edge, looking down at the world, counting off the banners and squadrons as he marked them in his head. What would Klossen Bayer have done with one of these, he wondered. Maybe the Battle of Koldasar would have turned out differently. He'd have never lost his cavalry in the marsh, that's for certain. Matt's forces continued to hold back the shadow at the eastern border of Kandor, but he was not pleased with the current situation. The nature of Bryn's trap had been subtle, as hard to see as a yellow flower spider crouching on a petal. That's how Matt had known. It had taken true military genius to put the army into such a bad situation without it looking like the army was in a bad situation. That sort of thing didn't happen by accident. Matt had lost more men than he wanted to count. His people were pressed up against the river, and Demandred, despite continuing to rave about the dragon reborn, was continually testing Matt's defenses, trying to find a weak spot, sending out a heavy cavalry raid against one side, then an attack from Sharan archers and a Trolloc charge on the other. Consequently, Matt had to keep a close eye on Demandred's movements to be able to counter them in time. Night was coming soon. Would the shadow pull back? The Trollocs could fight into the darkness, but those Sharans probably couldn't. Matt gave another sequence of orders, and messengers galloped through gateways to deliver them. It seemed like only moments passed before his troops below responded. "So fast," Matt said.
"This will change the world," General Golgon said. "Messengers can respond instantly. Commanders can watch their battles and plan in the moment."
Matt grunted in agreement.
"I'll bet it still takes all bloody evening to get dinner from the mess tent, though."
Golgon actually smiled. It was like seeing a boulder crack in half.
"Tell me, General," Tuan said. "What is your assessment of our consort's abilities?"
"I don't know where you found this one, greatest one. But he is a diamond
tent, though." Golgon actually smiled. It was like seeing a boulder crack in half.
"Tell me, General," Tuan said. "What is your assessment of our consort's abilities?"
"I don't know where you found this one, greatest one. But he is a diamond of great worth. I have watched him these last hours as he rescued the forces of the White Tower. For all of his unconventional style, I have rarely seen a battle commander as gifted as he."
Tuan did not smile, but he could see from her eyes that she was pleased. They were nice eyes, and actually, with Golgon not acting so gruff, perhaps this wouldn't be such a bad place to be after all. "Thanks," Matt said under his breath to Golgon as they both leaned over to study the field below.
"I consider myself a man of truth, my prince," Golgon said, rubbing his chin with a calloused finger. "You will serve the Crystal Throne well. It would be a shame to see you assassinated too early. I will make certain that the first I send after you are newly trained, so that you may stop them with ease."
Matt felt his mouth drop open. The man said it with perfect frankness, almost affection, as if he were planning to do Matt a favor by trying to kill him. "The Trollocs here," he pointed at a group of them far below, "will pull back soon."
"I concur," Golgon said.
Matt rubbed his chin.
"We'll have to see what Demandred does with them. I'm concerned that the Sharans may try to slip some of their Marath Damani into our camp during the night. They show a remarkable dedication to their cause, or a bloody foolish disregard for self-preservation."
Aes Sedai and Suldam weren't particularly timid, but they were generally cautious. The Sharan channelers were anything but, particularly the men.
"Give me some Damani to create lights for the river," Matt said. "And put the camp on lockdown, with a ring of Damani spaced through camp to watch for channeling. Nobody channels, not even to light a bloody candle."
"The Aes Sedai may not like this," General Golgon said.
He too hesitated upon using the words Aes Sedai. They had started using the term instead of Marath Damani by Matt's order, one that he'd expected Tuan to rescind. She had not. Figuring that woman out was going to be a real pleasure,
if they both survived this bloody mess.
Ty Lee entered a room. Tall and with a scarred face, the dark-skinned woman walked with the confidence of a long-time soldier. She prostrated herself before Tuan, her clothing bloodied and her armor dented. Her legion had taken a beating today, and she probably felt like a rug did after a good wife had been at it.
"I'm worried about our position here." Matt turned back and squatted down, looking through the hole.
As he'd predicted, the Trollocs had begun to fall back.
"In what way?" General Golgon asked.
"We've run our channelers to the bone," Matt said, "and we're backed up against the river. A difficult position to defend long term, especially against such a huge army. If they channel some gateways and move part of the Sharn army to this side of the river in the night, they could crush us."
"I see what you mean," Golgon said, shaking his head. "Given their strength, they will continue to wear us down until we are so weak they can throw a noose around us and tighten it."
Matt looked directly at Golgon.
"I think it's time we abandon this position."
"I agree. That seems to be our only reasonable course of action," General Golgon said, nodding. "Why not choose a battlefield more to our advantage? Will your friends from the White Tower agree to a retreat?"
"Let's see," Matt said, straightening all the way up. "Someone send for Egwene and the sisters."
"They will not come," Tuan said. "The Aes Sedai will not meet with us here. I doubt this Ammerlin will accept me into her camp, not with the protections I would require."
"Fine," Matt waved toward the gateway in the floor, which the Demani was closing. "We'll use a gateway and talk through it like a door." Tuan made no specific objection, so Matt sent the messengers. It took a little arranging, but Egwene seemed to like the idea well enough. Tuan entertained herself during the wait by having her throne moved to the other side of the room. Matt had no idea why. She then proceeded to begin annoying Min.
"And this one?"
Tuan asked as a lanky member of the Blood entered and bowed himself.
"He'll marry soon," Min said. "You will give me the omen first," Tuan said. "Then interpretation, if you desire."
"I know exactly what this one means," Min protested. She'd been set on a smaller throne beside that of Tuan. The girl was so decked in fine cloth and lace that she could have been mistaken for a mouse hiding in a bale of silk.
"Sometimes I know immediately, and—" "You will give the omen first," Tuan said, her tone unchanged. "And you will refer to me as Greatest One. It is a high honor that you are given to speak with me directly. Do not let the Prince of the Raven's attitude prove a model for your own."
Min quieted, though she didn't look cowed. She'd spent too long around Aes Sedai to let Tuan bully her. That gave Matt pause. He had an inkling of what Tuan might be capable of if she grew displeased with Min. He loved her, like he was pretty sure he did, but he also let himself be a little afraid of her. He'd have to keep watch so that Tuan didn't decide to educate Min.
"The omen for this man," Min said, controlling her tone with, it seemed, some difficulty, "is white lace trailing in a pond. I know that it will mean his marriage in the near future."
Tuan nodded. She wiggled her fingers at Seleucia. The man they were discussing was of the low blood, not of a high enough rank to speak directly to Tuan. His head was down so close to the ground as he bowed that it seemed that he had become fascinated with beetles and was trying to collect a specimen.
"Lord Gokhan of the Blood," Seleucia voiced, "is to be moved to the front lines. He is forbidden to marry until the end of this conflict. The omens have spoken that he will live long enough to find a wife, and so he will be protected."
Min grimaced, then opened her mouth, probably to object that it didn't work that way. Matt caught her eye and shook his head, and she backed down. Tuan brought in the next, a young soldier, not of the Blood. The woman had fair skin and not a bad face, though Matt couldn't see much else beneath that armor. Men's armor and women's armor didn't actually look much different, which he found a shame. Matt had asked a Shonshan armorer if certain areas of the female breastplate shouldn't be emphasized, so to speak, and the armorer had looked at him like he was a half-wit. Right, these people had no sense of morality. A fella needed to know if he was fighting a woman on the battlefield. It was only right. As Min gave her omens, Matt settled back in his chair, putting his boots up on the map table, and fishing in his pocket for his pipe. She was rather fine-looking, that soldier, though he could not see some of the important parts. She might make a good match for Tomanus. That fellow spent entirely too little time looking at women. He was shy around them, Tomanus was. Matt ignored the looks of those nearby as he tipped his chair back onto two legs, set his heels on the table, and packed his pipe. Shonshan could be so touchy. He wasn't certain what he thought of so many Shonshan women being soldiers. A lot of them seemed like Brigitte, which wouldn't be so bad. Matt would rather spend an evening in the tavern with her than half the men he knew. "You will be executed," Tuan voiced through Seleucia, speaking to the soldier. Matt nearly fell off of his chair. He grabbed the table in front of him, the chair's front legs slamming down on the ground. "What?" Min demanded. "No!" "You saw the sign of the white boar," Tuan said. "I don't know the meaning." "The boar is the symbol of one Han Doin, one of my rivals in Shonshan," Tuan explained patiently. "The white boar is an omen of danger, perhaps betrayal. This woman works for him, or will, in the future." "You can't just execute her!" Tuan blinked once, looking straight at Min. The room seemed to drop into shade, feeling colder. Matt shivered. He didn't like it when Tuan got like this. That stare of hers. It seemed like the stare of another person. A person without compassion. A statue had more life to it. Nearby, Seleucia wiggled her fingers at Tuan. Tuan glanced at them, then nodded. "You are my truth speaker," she said to Min, almost reluctantly. "You may correct me in public. Do you see error in my decisions?" "Yes, I do," Min said, not missing a beat. "You do not use my skills as you should." "And how should I?" Tuan asked. The soldier who had been given a death sentence continued lying prostrate. She didn't object. She was not of a rank that could address the Empress. She was lowly enough that speaking to someone else in Tuan's presence would be a breach of honor. "What someone may do is not grounds to kill them," Min said. "I intend no disrespect, but if you are going to kill people because of what I tell you, I will not speak."
"You can be made to speak. Try it," Min said softly.
Matt started. Bloody ashes, she looked as cold as Tuan had a moment ago.
"Let us see how the pattern treats you, Empress, if you torture the bearer of omens."
Instead, Tuan smiled.
"You take to this well. Explain to me what you desire, bringer of omens."
"I will tell you my viewings," Min said. "But from now on, the interpretations, whether my own or those you read into the images, are to be kept quiet. Between the two of us would be best. You are allowed to watch someone because of what I've said, but not to punish them. Not unless you catch them doing something. Set this woman free."
"Let it be so," Tuan said. "You are free," she voiced through Seleucia. "Walk in loyalty to the Crystal Throne. You will be watched."
The woman bowed lower, then retreated from the room, head down. Matt caught a trickle of sweat running down the side of her face. So she wasn't a statue. He turned back to Tuan and Min. They were still staring at one another. No knives, but he felt as if someone had been stabbed. If only Min would learn a little respect. One of these days he was going to have to haul her away from the Shonshan by her collar, a step in front of the headsman, he was certain of it. A gateway suddenly split the air on the side of the room where Tuan had indicated it should go. Suddenly it occurred to Matt why she had moved her throne. If that Damani had been captured and forced to say where Tuan was sitting, an Aes Sedai could have opened a gateway where she sat, slicing her in two. It was so unlikely it was laughable. An Aes Sedai could sooner fly than kill someone who wasn't a dark friend. But Tuan took no chances. The gateway opened to reveal the Hall of the Tower seated in a tent. Behind them, Egwene sat upon a large chair. The Ammerlin seat itself, Matt realized. Blood and ashes. She had them fetch it. Egwene looked exhausted, though she was doing a good job of hiding it. The others were no better. The Aes Sedai had been strained to their limits. If she were a soldier, he'd never send her into battle. Blood and bloody ashes. If he had a soldier with that cast to his skin and that look in his eyes, Matt would send the fellow to bed rest for a week. "We are curious to know the purpose of this meeting," Saren said calmly. Sylviana sat in a smaller chair by Egwene's side, and the other sisters were organized by Aja. Some were missing, including one of the Yellows, by Matt's best guess. Tuan nodded to Matt. He was to lead this meeting. He tipped his hat to her, which earned him a half-raised eyebrow. Her dangerous look was gone, although she was still Empress. "Aes Sedai," Matt said, standing up and tipping his hat to the sitters. "The Crystal Throne appreciates you coming to your bloody senses and letting us direct the battle." Sylviana's eyes bulged as if someone had just stepped on her foot. From the corner of his eye, Matt caught a hint of a smile on Tuan's lips. Blood and bloody ashes, both women should know better than to encourage him so. "You are as eloquent as ever, Matt," Egwene said dryly. "Do you still have your pet fox?"
"I do," Matt said. "He's snuggled up nice and warm."
"Take care of him," Egwene said. "I would not see you suffer Garth Bryn's fate."
"So it was really compulsion?" Matt asked.
Egwene had sent him word.
"As near as we can tell," Saren said. "Nynaeve Sedai can see the weaves on someone's mind, I'm told, but none of the rest of us can."
"We have our healers looking at Bryn," said a stocky Damani Aes Sedai. "For now, we cannot trust any battle plans that he touched, at least not until we determine how long he's been under the Shadow's thumb."
Matt nodded.
"That sounds good. Also, we need to withdraw our forces from the fort."
"Why?"
Lelaine demanded.
"We have stabilized here."
"Not well enough," Matt said. "I don't like this terrain, and we shouldn't have to fight where we don't want to."
"I hesitate to give an extra inch to the Shadow," Saren said.
"A pace given up now could earn us two at the dawn," Matt replied.
General Gorgon murmured in agreement, and Matt realized that he'd quoted Hawkwing. Saren frowned. The others seemed to be letting her lead the meeting. Egwene mostly stayed out of it, fingers laced before her, sitting at the back.
"I should probably tell you," Saren said, "that our great captain was not the only one targeted. Devrim Bashir and Lord Agalmar also tried to lead their respective armies to destruction. Elaine Sedai did well in her battle, destroying a large force of Trollocs, but she was only able to do so because of the Black Tower's arrival. The Borderlanders were crushed, losing nearly two-thirds of their numbers."
Matt felt a chill. Two-thirds? Light. They were among the best troops the Light had.
"Lan?"
"Lord Mandragoran lives," Saren said.
"Well, that was something. And what of that army up in the Blight?"
"Lord Iteralda fell in battle," Saren replied. "No one quite seems to know what happened to him."
"This was planned very well," Matt said, mind racing. "Blood and bloody ashes. They tried to crush all four battle fronts at once. I can't imagine the amount of coordination that would take."
"As I noted," Egwene said softly, "we must be very careful. Keep that fox of yours near at all times."
"What does Elaine want to do?" Matt said. "Isn't she in charge?"
"Elaine Sedai is currently helping the Borderlanders," Saren said. "She has instructed us that Shinar is all but lost, and is having the Ashaman bring Lord Mandragoran's army to a place of safety.
Tomorrow she plans to move her army through gateways and hold the Trollocs in the Blight.
Matt shook his head. We need to make a unified stand. He hesitated.
Could we bring her through one of these gateways? At least contact her?
There seemed to be no good objection. In a short time, another gateway opened in the tent with Egwene and the sitters. Elaine strode through, thick with child, eyes practically on fire. Behind her, Matt caught a glimpse of soldiers with slumped postures, trudging across a dim evening field.
Light, Elaine said. Matt, what is it you want?
You've won your battle? Matt asked.
Barely, but yes. The Trollocs in Kyrian have been destroyed. The city is safe as well.
Matt nodded. I need to withdraw from our position here.
Fine, Elaine said. Perhaps we can meld your force with what's left of the Borderlanders.
I want to do more than that, Elaine, Matt said, stepping forward. This ploy the Shadow tried. It was clever, Elaine. Bloody clever. We're bloodied and almost broken. We don't have the luxury of fighting on multiple battlefronts anymore.
What then?
A last stand, Matt said softly. All of us, together, at one place where the terrain favors us. Elaine quieted, and someone brought her a chair to sit beside Egwene. She maintained the posture of a queen, but her disheveled hair and clothing burned in several places indicated what she'd been through. Matt could smell smoke coming from her battlefield, where the gateway was still open.
That sounds desperate, Elaine finally said. We are desperate, Saren said. We should ask our commanders,
Elaine trailed off.
If there are any we can trust not to be under compulsion.
There's only one, Matt said grimly, meeting her eyes. And he's telling you we are finished if we continue as we have. The earlier plan was a good enough one, but after what we lost today... Elaine, we're dead, unless we choose one place to stand, gather together and fight. One last toss of the dice. Elaine sat for a time.
Where?
She finally asked.
Tarvolin?
Gawain asked.
No,
Matt said. They just besiege it and move on. It can't be a city where we can get boxed in. We need a territory that will work in our favor, also a land that can't feed the Trollocs.
Well, a place in the Borderlands should work for that, Elaine said with a grimace. Land's army burned almost every city or field they passed to deny the Shadow resources.
Maps, Matt said, waving. Someone get me maps. We need a location in southern Shinar or Arafel, someplace close enough that the Shadow will see it as tempting, a place to fight us all at once.
Matt, Elaine asked, won't they be giving them what they want? A chance to wipe us out?
Yes, Matt said softly as the Aes Sedai sent over maps. These had markings on them, notations that appeared to be in General Bryn's hand, judging by what they said.
We have to be a tempting target. We have to draw them in, face them, and either defeat them or be crushed.
A drawn-out fight would serve the Shadow. Once enough Trollocs reached southern lands, there would be no containing them. He had to win or lose quickly. One last toss of the dice indeed. Matt pointed at a location on the maps, a place that Bryn had annotated. It had a good water supply, a nice meeting of hills and rivers.
This place, Marilor. You've been using it as a supply dump?
Saren chuckled softly.
And so we go back where we began, do we? It does have some small fortifications, Elaine said. The men built a palisade on one side, and we could expand it.
It's what we need, Matt said, envisioning a battle there. Marilor would put them where the two major Trolloc armies could come in, try to crush the humans between them. That would be tempting. But the terrain would be wonderful for Matt to use. Yes. It would be like the Battle of Priam Narrows. If he put archers along those cliffs? No, dragons. And if he could give the Aes Sedai a few days of rest? Priam Narrows.
He had counted on using a large river to trap the Himarian army at the mouth of the Narrows. But as he sprung the trap, the blasted river dried up on him. The Himarians had dammed it up on the other side of the Narrows. They had stepped right over the riverbed and got clean away. That's a lesson I won't forget.
This will do, Matt said, placing his hand on the map. Elaine?
Let it be done, Elaine said. I hope you know what you're doing, Matt.
As she spoke, the dice started tumbling inside his head. Galad closed Trom's eyes. He'd searched the battlefield north of Kyrian for over an hour to find him. Trom had bled out, and only a few corners of his cloak were still white. Galad ripped the officer's knots off his shoulder, amazingly unsoiled, and stood up. He felt weary to the bone. He started back across the battlefield, passing heaps of the dead. The crows and the ravens had come. They blanketed the landscape behind him. An undulating, quivering blackness that coated the ground like mold. From a distance, it seemed as if the ground had been burned. There were so many carrion birds. Occasionally, Galad passed men like himself who sifted through the corpses for friends. There were surprisingly few looters. You had to watch for those on a battlefield. Elaine had caught a few trying to sneak out of Kyrian. She'd threatened to hang them.
She's grown harder, Galad thought, trudging back toward camp.
His boots felt like lead on his feet.
That is good.
As a child, she had often made decisions with her heart. She was a queen now, and acted it. Now if only he could write her moral compass. She wasn't a bad person, but Galad wished that she, like other monarchs, could see as clearly as he did. He was beginning to accept that they didn't. He was beginning to accept that it was all right, so long as they tried their best. Whatever he had inside of him that allowed him to see the right of things was obviously a gift of the light, and holding others to scorn because they had not been born with it was wrong. Just as it would be wrong to hold a man to scorn because he had been born with only one hand, and was therefore an inferior swordsman. Many of the living he passed sat on the ground in the rare spots where there were no corpses and no blood. These men did not look like the victors of a battle, though the arrival of the Ashaman had saved this day. The trick with the lava had given Elaine's army the breather it needed to regroup and attack. That battle had been swift, but brutal. Trollocs did not surrender, and they couldn't be allowed to break and flee. So Galad and the others had fought, bled, and died long past when it was obvious they would be victorious. The Trollocs were dead now. The remaining men sat and stared out at the blanket of corpses, as if numbed by the prospect of searching out the few living among the many thousands dead. The setting sun and choking clouds made the light red and gave faces a bloody cast. Galad eventually reached the long hill that had marked the division between the two battlefields. He climbed it, slowly, forcing down thoughts of how good a bed would feel, or a pallet on the floor, or some flat rock in an out-of-the-way place where he could roll up in his cloak. The fresher air atop the hill shocked him. He'd been smelling blood and death for so long that now it was the clean air that smelled wrong. He shook his head, walking past tired borderlanders who were trudging through gateways. The Ashaman had gone to hold off the Trollocs to the north, so Lord Mandragoran's armies could escape. From what Galad heard, the borderlander armies were a fraction of what they had been. The betrayal of the great captains had been felt most deeply by Lord Mandragoran and his men. It sickened Galad, for this battle had not gone easily for him or anyone else with Elaine. It had been horrible. And as bad as it had been, the fight had gone more poorly for the borderlanders. Galad kept his stomach settled with difficulty as his view from atop the hill let him see just how many carrion birds had come to feast. The Dark One's minions fell, and the Dark One's minions glutted themselves. Galad eventually found Elaine. Her passionate words, being spoken to Tamal Thor Narganda, took him by surprise.
"Matt is right," she said. "The Field of Miralor is a good battlefield. Light, I wish we could give the people more time to rest. We'll have only a few days, a week at most, before the Trollocs reach Miralor behind us."
She shook her head.
"We should have seen those Sharans coming. When the deck starts to look like it's stacked against the Dark One, of course he will just add a few new cards to the game."
Galad's pride demanded that he remain standing as he listened to Elaine talk to the other commanders. For once, however, his pride lost out, and he settled down on a stool and slumped forward.
"Galad," Elaine said, "you really should allow one of the Ashaman to wash away your fatigue. Your insistence upon treating them like outcasts is foolish."
Galad straightened up.
"It has nothing to do with the Ashaman," he snapped.
Too argumentative. He was tired.
"This fatigue reminds me of what we lost today. It is an exhaustion my men must endure, and so I will, lest I forget just how tired they are and push them too far."
Elaine frowned at him. He had stopped worrying that his words offended her long ago. It seemed he couldn't claim that a day was pleasant or his tea warm without her taking offense somehow. It would have been nice if Ebara hadn't run off. That man was a leader, one of the few that Galad had ever met, that one could actually talk to without worrying that he'd take offense. Perhaps the Two Rivers would be a good place for the White Cloaks to settle. Of course, there was something of a history of bad blood between them. He could work on that. "I called them White Cloaks," he thought to himself a moment later. "Inside my head, that's how I thought of the children just now." It had been a long time since he'd done that by accident.
"Your Majesty," Arganda said.
He stood beside Loghain, the leader of the Ashaman, and Javian Norell, the new commander of the Winged Guard. Talmanis of the Band of the Red Hand trudged up with a few commanders from the Saldaeans and the Legion of the Dragon. Elder Hammon of the Ogier sat on the ground a short distance away. He stared off toward the sunset, seeming dazed.
"Your Majesty," Arganda continued, "I realize you consider this a great victory."
"It is a great victory," Elaine said. "We must persuade the men to see it that way. Not 8 hours ago, I assumed that our entire army would be slaughtered. We won. At a cost of half of our troops," Arganda said softly. "I will count that a victory," Elaine insisted. "We were expecting complete destruction."
"The only victor today is the Butcher," Narelle said softly.
He looked haunted.
"No," Tamal Thor said. "She's right. The troops have to understand what their losses earned. We must treat this as a victory. It must be recorded that way in the histories, and the soldiers must be convinced to see it so."
"That is a lie," Galad found himself saying.
"It is not," Althor said. "We lost many friends today, like that we all did. Focusing on death, however, is what the Dark One wants us to do. I dare you to tell me I'm wrong. We must look and see light, not shadow, or we'll all be pulled under."
"By winning here,"
Elaine said, deliberately emphasizing the word,
"we earn a reprieve. We can gather at Miralor, entrench there, and make our last stand in our strength against the shadow."
"Light," Talmanis whispered. "We're going to go through this again, aren't we?"
"Yes,"
Elaine said reluctantly. Galad looked out over the fields of the dead, then shivered.
"Miralor will be worse. Light, help us. It's going to get worse."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.